It's another Sunday afternoon and time for another Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. At the end of this month, on the 25th through the 27th of September, Lenore Ryan College is hosting a celebration of the spirit of Black Mountain College. Today, we'll be listening to some of the work of one of the featured readers at that celebration, Thomas Meyer. Thomas is a consummate poet. He makes everything look extraordinarily easy. If he were a classical pianist, I'm sure he could give a reading of Rachmaninoff's Third that would be note perfect, in spite of the fact that it's one of the most difficult pieces in the repertoire, without even having to wipe the sweat off his brow. Thomas is the author of The Bang Book, Stays Callum's Legends, At Dusk Iridescent, Coromando, and most recently, translator of the Tao Te Ching. Let's start by listening to a reading from 1994, one that was recorded at Swansdale in Yorkshire at midsummer, June 21st, 1994. And then we'll go directly to a reading from September 30th, 2005, at the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center.
Since it's midsummer, I thought I would read something murky, anecdote. I've just had a book, I'm just about to have a book come out in London, which are actually translations or disfigurations or pulling apart of German Romantic poetry, and it was in collaboration with an artist in London, and she did monotypes. Murky monotypes, and it was German Romanticism was our heavy input. This is, and what I would like to do is read these six poems by Heine, which were six poems that Schubert set at the end of his life. And it's called Heine's Swan only because Schubert's six poems were, the six settings were chucked together with four other settings by another poet and published after his lifetime by his son and his publisher as Schubert's swan song. So there's a kind of mistake, a deliberate mistake here. Heine's Swan, Atlas. Little did I know this world, this whole world of regret would break me. This heart who asked to ache endlessly with either grief or rapture is racked with sorrow. Ihr Bild. A dark dream I am standing in, and her likeness transfixes me, and her face, so dear to me, takes on a dark life of its own. A smile and something amazing parts her lips, each eye shining with, are they tears? Tears they are that run down my cheeks. Will I ever finally arrive at your going from me? Amère. As far as eyes saw the sea lit with the sun's last light, alone we sat, not talking near an isolated fisherman's hut. Rolled, swelled, fog, waves, seagulls lifted, then fell, again, eyes filled with love let go, tears a flood. I watched them fall to your hand and fell to my knees, pressed my lips to your white hand and tasted your tears, and from that moment on I was weak and overwhelmed with longing, poisoned by those tears, woman's grief. Der Doppelganger. The night silent, the streets empty, the house once my love lived in, the town she left some time since. The house sits still in the same street. A man in it stands and stares. at the sky. He wrings his hands, anguish. I catch the look on his face, horror. It's my own, the moon shows me. Shadow, fellow, double, traveler. You rehearse this pain, loves. Why? Once upon a time, night after night, in the same place, it tortured me. Das Fischermachen. Pull in your line, good-looking girl. Row your boat to shore. Come here and sit. Just sit and hold my hand. Put your head here against my heart. Don't be frightened. Every morning you row out onto an ocean whose weather's no more unpredictable than my heart's, and deep beneath them both are hidden, priceless pearls. Die Stadt. Gone, then there again. Upon the horizon, the town, its towers, that fading light. A fresh wind pleats the dull sea, steady, sad strokes. A sailor rows the boat. The sun, one quick last glimpse, stares and marks for me that spot where my love was lost. Thank you. I thought I would like to start by reading a couple of short, occasional poems, because actually, while putting these things together the other day, or thinking what I should read, I suddenly thought, why, you know, what, where does the poem come from? And thought maybe I have written poems for weddings and birthdays and even illnesses, so I thought maybe start with these short occasional poems, then read sections from sort of longer projects. So, this is a poem called Calico about, and I should shut up because the poem's very short, about mountain laurel, and it was written for a celebration of a very distinguished naturalist who had written a natural history on highlands, and this was in a book for him. Calico. This mountain laurel is an apron whose delicacy is no silly frill, pink and girlish, but whose hem takes up May. Epithalamium. Susan and Joseph are come unto the garden, and under an arbor, vines of two stalks knit their tent so tightly none can tell one's tendril from the other, hung heavy and purple with grapes, days beyond them turned to wine. And this is a poem written for Guy Davenport's 50th birthday, but recently I kind of shifted it to just be for him on his death. He died in January. And I figured it could do dual, or it could stop being a 50th birthday poem and be a commemoration. Guy was a translator and did some famous translations of Sappho, so it's very Sapphic. Softly curled, shoulder length, larkspur, look, swallows. Circle her, her foot lifts, thistle down, honey thick, hides each ankle, apricots, scatter this wind-run meadow after her, her basket and red sash. The shore. Imagine a lake on whose far shore your father lies dying. Imagine only a bladder infection, a night in the hospital, intravenous antibiotics, an aggressive approach. My hand on his shoulder, then brow. He opens his eyes and stares at me. Trying to lift himself, I offer an arm. He refuses. Imagine a lake forever to cross. And the last of these is a poem written for Robert Kelly, the poet and a great teacher at Bard College, for his 70th birthday, which was just this last month. This early morning, late September, I opened the car door and stepped out onto the asphalt at the 24-hour Walmart in Clayton, Georgia, and was welcomed into
the arms of this light breeze carried upon a faint pink and bright azure. I hardly knew where I was, nor who was this I. For a period of about 10 years, did three collaborations with the artist Sandra Fisher, who died about 11 years ago, well, exactly 11 years ago this month, suddenly and tragically. She was married to R.B. Kitai, the painter, and we did three books together, which were collaborations. The first was I did some translations of Sappho, and she did some pastel drawings. And then the second book was a book of sonnets, and she did paintings that were inspired by the Impressionists and sensuality and sun and light. And I did sonnets that were kind of from the same period, of drawing on Baudelaire and Rimbaud. And this is a crown of sonnets, meaning there are seven sonnets. And the last line of the first sonnet becomes the next line of the next sonnet and so forth until the seven lines of the seven alternating lines, God, of the last sonnet. It doesn't sound that bad. Sonnets for Sandra, a crown. This form is called a crown. One, Tom is trying to write these sonnets for Sandra, or to be more specific, they're for her pleasure as well as his, because of the longing they share to set desire in a natural light, to draw up what is felt like well water, stark as India ink is that passion, and arctic with the pressure of all their want. Swooning, breathless, they boldly dare put themselves at art's mercy, beauty's je ne sais quoi. So there we have the question of tone, gravity, and that awful modern problem of how close to irony the heart comes in its sincerity. Still, I'm not convinced the answer is brevity, and persist in surrendering to these feelings too frequently dismissed as being only frou-frou. Two, frequent but dismissed for being only frou-frou, such sentiments, these affects, depend on second thoughts, sexual daydreams, ordinary though conned edges of habit, of routine, and what they do is demand, despite their tremulous déjà vu-ness, a devotion almost Mayan in its blend of exaltation and obsession, their sole end to turn anticipation into rendezvous. Let me warn you, though, I've been prone to every sort of waffle and intellectual ratatouille, thinking a la mode, Heidegger, Barthes, Bachelard, Sartre, birth signs, good karma, tarot and tofu, tahuil, almost anything but that less than obvious fact, rather than complex, what complicates is simple. Three, rather than complex, what complicates is simple? Admittedly, that does sound a bit pretentious, as well as that remark about anticipation turning into meeting. Both, for example, are obvious, aren't they? Nothing to make a fuss about, much less provoke the swanking I'm undone by too often. Wanting to be simple, the dumb thing is I'm always straining for a thousand glossy facets while telling myself time and again, keep those excesses to a minimum. Bridle their tendency. Let the sensual numb. Doesn't always work. Just can't help it when some line pops into my head right out of a song like, whenever I hear your name, my heart beats like a drum. Four, hearing his name did make my heart beat like a drum. My first falling in love was so fraught with cliché that some still maintain their green for me, even stay clipped with sadness, hedged in rampant loss. His name, Jim. But that's a vita nuova all my own. Him and what happened, I'll try to say later. Well, here the mood requires casualness, okay? Intimacy I'm aiming for, not tedium. Do our depths dictate what we talk about, or don't? Not that I try to rhyme in sonnet on sonnet for its psychopathology of everyday life. Yet certain petty, obscure desires seem as if they formed pantheons whose duly appointed ranks look after a life's incidental, day-to-day tenor. Five. Is life accidental day to day? Do 10 or 12 household gods, call them, take turns monitoring? Let's say the simpler situations during one's waking hours. Are they none the less than minor emanations of art's great triple avatar, style, content, form? Their aegis of gilt-edged meaning highlights the commonplace. Spear, lyre, or ring, summon the humdrum broom, wedding band, old guitar. Just the same, we must keep all this partly mundane. The world we know made much of, never let go of. Such pretension could ruin. It seems certain our real threat is a slow waste, not of limb or love, but felicity. Yes, though, what does that mean? Well, an uncertain rightness, fragile, artificial. 6. An uncertain, slight, less fragile, superficial occasions, the ordinary will suddenly open out like one of those fortune flowers we used to make as kids. With its blossoming, we'd spell some word, L-O-V-E, that held in its final yawn the petal under whose crease some phrase would be. You are quite charming. Don't say anything silly. Which could mean, if only they made sense, one special wish might come true. Can we be taught the tentative to memorize ambiguity or learn Zen by heart? Is experience made up of patches of elaborate patterns boldly outlined in simple shapes? Don't they call that imari? Caches of odd senses called from the senses' fine mesh sieve? These moments, 7, these moments called from the senses' fine mesh sieve astonish just because they seem able to give the uncertain a rightness, perhaps artificial, when they firmly lay the focus of our attention on life's incidental, ordinary tenor, which in its way is almost like falling in or out of love. Think how such details jam the tongue, how hearing a name leaves the heart beating like a drum. Whether one's desires seem more Manet than Ingres, rather than complex, what complicates is simple sensuality, the recollection of a few frequent moments deemed to be no more than frou-frou, remains one truth art seems almost able to handle. That is why Tom's writing these sonnets for Sandra. Talking earlier about the occasion of a poem, and these obviously were the occasion of this collaboration and relationship, I also am, like all good modernist, old-fashioned modernists, interested in the poem itself being the occasion. And the rule I set myself is not to write a poem about writing a poem. So I wrote a long poem that then became the first part of a book called Coromandel. The poem is called Book Two. I thought, wouldn't that be great to call a poem Book Two? And then it assumes there's a Book One, and maybe there's a Book Three, Four, Five, Six, on. But it just begins with Book Two. And I also was interested in the idea of fragmentation, again, the old-fashioned idea of the fragment, the glittering, the luminous fragment. And thinking rather than that kind of cranky modernist idea about it being a ruin, that the fragment would just be interruption. So there would be like channel surfing, so you'd hear lots of different things. So this isn't the whole thing, I'm just going to read a few pages from Coromandel. And the first section, which is called Book Two. And you know, I'm standing up here suddenly realizing I'm not wearing my glasses. But I guess I'll try to keep on going. I think maybe I should get them. This is all hard. John Wiener's the poet. When I was at Bard, I had him come to read, and the first thing he did was spill all of his papers off the podium, and then leaned down, his glasses fell off, and stepped on them. And after the reading, he said to me, how did you like the reading? And I said, oh, John, it was marvelous, despite it. And he had staged the whole thing. And he said, I thought it would give it more poignancy. Book two. Despite constrained petals, the bud opens. The tailor squinting, other side of his needle. Afternoon, afternoon, parade of dull clouds. Pure vowels, the map clearly shows the road, but never the single figure walking it. Her voice comes from behind a black curtain. The sources are dark. You've come this way to find light. Summer heat, gust of air. Where does this dream take us? Morning comes to Indiana, Ohio, and Kansas. Moves over water, cerebral caves, frontal regions, mysteries hide from the surgeon's wires in. Sheep come up from the dip, cars out of a car wash, economics, 1 to 10, Albigensian serpents slither back to Galilee. He caught many splendid fish in his net, one for each fruit of the Jew's tree. Along the Nile grow cotton, papyrus, and the moon, waters that flow into Africa's heart. Why is night an indifferent rest? It isn't. The law is broken, spreading like wildfire since Lincoln was shot. Worms thrive on the tidy earth above. An animal sits in the hot sunlight. Narcissus saw himself, fearful, even in his innocence. Children wake in the wilderness and complain of angels, lost in mourning to tent pegs, pans, camels. It all seems on the surface, history and bad poetry. Blue water makes us forget. The man walks away from the ink in an Arab boy's hand. Midsummer. Moses in his sleep takes us where seas part, right and gracious season. Stars in their stations stand and guard our quiet night. Red velvet, she sings, inside her white skin and black hair. Enchantment nets, seamless blue, ensnares this entire scene. The sound of waves, the sound the sun hums, and the moon echoes, guiding tides to that music. A garden of all the original vowels, the dream's source, the light's modulation. A universe based on falling from stars. A woman in the window fades, stares us in the face. The journey ends when? Time's dark. The city grows near. The wine ready. A ship waits in port. The weaver finds a map in the loom. His way home, time in and out untold. Where in Adam's sin lay the burden's distinction? Who is the young girl in the field who weeps? He never claimed he spoke to God, but what he said had never been said before. Listen to me, this happens. Which are the roads back? Can you see who carries the lamp, the sword? He sits on the black rock, curtains shake, warm winds on the hills, sun beats down on Jerusalem. No, he doesn't speak. Speaking doesn't happen here. The city we speak of where building continues aimlessly and workers grumble. Wages. The great grammarians built these walls. They studied dust in the wilderness. Lips, tired eyes, he shook. The woman he passed on the road said, don't be taken in. It's a fake. Where does the land end? How far does it go? I know where they bury the moon, but can't tell. Mother, you walk so fast, the dark is night. It's an old story. We don't have the time. Purple mountains, silver rivers. Can we understand what we said or heard? Only when asked does the door open. Every day the land sinks deeper into time, that variable. Pomme de terre, pomme d'amour. He came for cinnamon and saw them ride a white duck to the other side. Thank you.
This is Wordplay on WPVM 103.5, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Today we're listening to readings by and interviews with poet Thomas Meyer, author of At Dusk Iridescent, and most recently translator of the great Chinese classic, The Tao Te Ching. His version was published by Flood Editions in 2006. Let's listen now to part of an interview I did with Thomas in March of that year, shortly before his reading of the work at Asheville's Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center. Did you come to translate the Tao? This is a wonderful story. Well,
I kind of backed into it. As I tell people, I kind of backed into Taoism altogether. I had had a back injury and strained my back, and then the next day couldn't get out of bed, couldn't stand up. And I was in bed, and I had no idea how long I was going to be in bed. And I had just been to New York and had met him years before, the poet Jackson McClough, who had been close to John Cage and had been with Cage very involved with random processes and using the I Ching. And when I was 18, 19 and knew Jackson the first time around, I had not had any relationship with the I Ching at all. In fact, it had constantly told me to get lost and get out of here, kid.
Youthful folly.
Absolutely. So I thought, well, I don't want anything more to do with this. So there I am in bed, with unable to move, really. And Jackson McClough sent a gathering of poems. This was in 1989. And I started looking at them, and I suddenly realized how important he had been to me, Jackson McClough had been to me, and mm-hmm. how this random method, this idea of the random method, and whether it involved the I Ching or not, had really opened up some things for me in a way which had made a great, great difference to me, and I'd really forgotten that. And for some reason, I decided this was the time to go back and look at the I Ching. And so I had a copy, the famous little gray Bullingen Press.
Wilhelm Baines.
Wilhelm Baines, Carol right. Baines translation.
Yeah.
And so I started looking at it, and it just clicked. It felt welcoming and present, and I was responding to it. And eventually I wound up getting up out of bed after about 10 days. And was having a hard time sitting. I could walk and run, but sitting in the car traveling. But a couple months later, I was in Lexington, Kentucky, and bought another translation of the I Ching that happened to have Chinese the Chinese text alongside it, not for the changing lines, but for the two major sections.
The image and
the judgment. Mm-hmm. So I thought, gosh, you know, and I was interested in translation as always as a poet, and I thought, gosh, I've got a Chinese dictionary. I could look these up. Wouldn't that be interesting to do that? And I started doing it, and it just kept on going for about 3 or 4 years, and that resulted in a translation of the I Ching. And it seemed to me, after I had finished that the obvious next thing to do would be the Tao Te Ching. And again, I had no intention, no obvious immediate intention of making a translation. My intention was to read the text, which mm-hmm. I'd had such a wonderful experience doing that with the I Ching, and the translation just simply flowed very easily and logically from that. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, a week or two into it, the first chapter came up, and I already had a kind of thing ringing in my head, and I just went ahead with it.
Yeah.
And I had figured out really a vocabulary was what I was looking for, a way of talking about it that wasn't too abstract, that was based in more an Anglo-Saxon or English rather than Latinate English mm-hmm. or English as a Romance language or mm-hmm. as a kind of derived from Romance languages, and a vocabulary that was more related to things like economics than philosophy, even a kind of business, a sort of simple business sense of things, rather than a philosophical or even religious New Age kind of. I was kind of trying to avoid the idea of spirit.
Uh-huh. And what's about the world? I mean,
It is how to live in the world.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is very practically about. Mm-hmm. There is a sort of statesmanship in it. There's a piece of it which is sometimes suspected to belong to another work or be separate from the rest of it, on how to run a state. Mm-hmm. But I thought, gosh, that's just how to run a business, how to run a committee, how to run a family, how to do things. Mm-hmm. And it just worked.
I guess while you were working on it, too, the most ancient versions of the text appeared.
Yes.
In the West.
That 73 discovery was being, Ballantine Books of all things was printing those, that collection. I don't know what's happened. They've printed a version of the I Ching, and they just, about that time that I was working on it, they came out with that very early version of the Tao Te Ching.
Mm-hmm. Was it Hinrichs who did
the translation and the edition for them, in which there were all of these interesting things, that the sections were reversed, that the section that's usually called the Tao appears after the section that's usually called the De. Uh-huh. And there were no chapter markings. The text just ran, started at the beginning and went to the end and stopped.
Right.
There's an internal section that's marked off, and it's unclear why that section has some dots on it. But I like to think, and I think I'm wrong, but I like to think that's that 17, 18, 19, is it? Chapters 17, 18, and 19, which is called the heart of the Tao, and it's the three chapters that are supposed to contain. It's like Tao light, mm-hmm. It's the quick start guide,
The quintessence,
the
cliff notes. Tao.
Yeah, I say when I talk about it that it's like when you buy a computer or you buy a DVD recorder. There's the manual. It's kind of this dull black and white book, and then there's this colorful brochure that opens up and tells you which chord to plug in where and how to start.
Right,
and that's it.
The quick start guide.
Yeah.
Well, please read for us some of the Tao. Now let's listen to that reading. This is Thomas Meyer reading from his translation of the Tao Te Ching at the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center in March of 2006.
I think I should tell you that I neither read Chinese nor write Chinese, much less speak it. What I was able to do was to use a Chinese dictionary. And I initially translated the I Ching about 10 years ago, and it really didn't start as a translation. It's the same story with the Tao Te Ching. I simply looked up every character one by one and read it without really making much sense of it. I did have other translations as cribs, but it was an immersion, a kind of total immersion in this experience of looking up these words and being so close to the text. It's like being close to a mountain or being close to a painting, like standing right here and going over this painting like that for a year and a half before pulling back and looking at it. So it's a kind of unusual way to begin. With the Tao Te Ching, no translation came. When I got done looking up every character, I would write it down, and I kept a database, and nothing happened. With the I Ching, a translation kind of popped out of me, slowly but surely. It's much longer work, but it did happen. With the Tao Te Ching, nothing happened, except that I went on to read it every spring, one section. There are 81 sections, one section a day for a month and a half, two months plus. And that was such an extraordinary experience. I was happy with that. And then only about two or three years ago, things started falling into place, and a translation began to come out of me for it. But what I would like to do initially is to show you some things. Anyone who knows about Chinese will be kind of bored with this sort of pedantic lecture, but it's also how I set about doing this. This is Jing. This is De, and this is Dao. So I'm going backwards here. But in this character, and this is the nature of Chinese itself, is the radical or the root word for silk. And because books were, it is also silk or silk threads or silk binding. It comes to mean, this word together comes to mean classics or books of information. This actually has nothing to do immediately with it. It's another word for Jing. It means water running underground. But that whole idea seemed to me kind of interesting, that this book, that the word, that the idea that meant book, the picture that meant book, also was hidden waterways, things running underground. So it was a kind of poetic frisson. This is the least interesting. This is De, which usually means, is translated rather simply and fast as virtue, which in fact it doesn't really mean that. Here we have a character that means setting forth with the left foot. Here we have the character for heart. And here we have a character which means 10 eyes and alignment. Apparently, in order, before the use of the plum for building, the idea was that you needed 10 eyes. Now, I don't know whether it's 10 pair of eyes or 5 people to look at a pillar and decide whether it was straight. You'd ask 5 people, does that look straight to you? And when you had 5 people saying yes, you knew you had a post that was upright and correct. And that is the uprightness of the heart. That's the correction of the heart so that we know that the heart is aligned and correctly in place. And this, meaning stepping forth with the left foot, encourages us, once we have that uprightness of the heart, to step forth with it to go out into the world. That once that internal state has been achieved, you set forth. This is Dao. And here we have, this is also kind of the element that happens in poetry in Chinese. Here we have an element that is also present here and here, the eye. So those two things have a harmony. And this of the stepping forth with the left foot is also here, just in a kind of abbreviated version. This little unit that's holding this piece here means long strides, stride, moving forward, but moving forward and halting, stopping and starting. And this is the eye, but it's not just the eye, it's the eye with hair on it. So that means not just seeing, but the whole head. So the major thing you're thinking about is seeing with your eyes, but it's still the head, not just perception alone. So from that, I would take or see that it's a matter, the Tao is a matter of going forth, stopping, looking, thinking, going forth, so that it's a hesitancy as well as a certain directness. So that, what I'm trying to say here is that that's the way I set about with this translation. These were the things I was working with every day, because I would have to, and now you can go to the internet and look these things up, bang. And I'd originally thought of making a database. This is in the late 80s, and I thought, gosh, let's have a hypertext translation where you could click on a character. And all of that exists now. And also, you can get versions of the Tao Te Ching, which are printed versions that do exactly this. So that I'm glad I did it when I did it, and this I had to do all of this by myself, because out of that came the translation. I think what I would like to do now is just start reading from sections from my translation. I did a couple unusual things. I decided that instead of translating it and presenting it section by section, the way it's usually done, little chapter by chapter by chapter, that I felt the text should just begin at the beginning and go to the end, and just simply, like thread off of a spool, just simply go. So I have no chapter breaks. I do. The text has got numbers, so you can find your way around on the outside margins, so you know that this is section two or this is section three. And I decided on a conversational voice rather than a canonical voice or a kind of old guy telling you what he thought voice. Lao Tzu, who is said to be the author of the Tao Te Ching, his name does mean old one or old person or old guy or old baby. So I thought that would make good sense. I think also before I read this, I'd like to read a little bit from the afterword, which is my kind of retelling of the story of how the Tao Te Ching got into existence. In some of these stories, Lao Tzu, who was very famous, a librarian actually, decides to leave China, and in some stories he gets on a blue ox and leaves. And in some versions, he has a young boy with him who is his helper. But I have him going on an ox that isn't blue and no little boy. Many years ago, an old man lived in the capital of a place called China. He was the emperor's librarian and renowned for having read everything there was to read. When the philosopher Confucius paid him his respects, he came away saying, "Birds fly, fish swim, animals run. They can be caught, shot, or trapped. But this old man is like an airborne dragon. He can't be snared." Then as now, things could not get worse, but did. Big troubles were afoot. Those with powers abused it. Those without grew cunning and two-faced. The old man could finally stomach no more greed, dishonesty, or corruption. The time had come, he told himself, to get out of China. He climbed upon an ox, leaving behind what little he owned, headed west toward the high mountains of another country. When he reached a gate that led up a steep pass, the border guard stopped him and said, "I recognize you and cannot let you go until you tell me everything you know. Otherwise, we will see all that is worthwhile swallowed up by all that is not." The old man welcomed a rest. The sun almost down, a bottle of wine opened. The two sat in the little station hut. The guard listened as the old man told him what he knew, which he said was not much. In fact, the moon was still in the middle of the sky when he got up to leave. He was never heard of again or seen. The 5,000 words spoken that night are all that is left of him, and that, in the mind of their speaker, was 5,000 too many. there is three sections, chapters, consecutive chapters of the original, in the original ordering or the traditional ordering, are said to be the heart of the Tao, or they're kind of Tao light. It's all you need is these three sections. And I have also been comparing them to that sort of quick start guide you get when you buy a computer, that you've got this thick black and white manual, and then you've got this colorful card that shows you where to plug the green plug and the blue plug, and then the plug into the wall and what button to hit, and the computer is on and you're running. So this is the essence of the Tao, and then we'll go back and read some more. "The best direction is barely felt. The next best is like a friend. Fear follows after that. Dismiss the last as useless. A lack of trust makes things untrustworthy. Quiet and in few words, finish what was begun, so that people say it simply happened on its own. When the great Tao is disabled, you need goodness and understanding. When wit and know-how are sold off, imitation is a necessity. When trust in the family gives way, loving relations are called for. When disorder and confusion take over, the devoted official appears. Get rid of the spiritual and let go of wisdom. This will improve things 100 times over. Get rid of good deeds and let go of one's duty. This will bring back needing and caring. Get rid of well-laid plans and let go of advantage. Then there will be no crooks or robbery. These three pieces of advice in themselves are not enough. So add to the above the following. Admire what is plain and hold on to what hasn't happened yet. Think less of yourself and whatever it is you want. So I thought I would go ahead and read a little bit more and then maybe just open things up for questions if there are any questions, and then sign some books if there are books to be signed. So these are them sort of reading around, but in a couple solid blocks. And again, this is just the way it moves from one piece to another. Don't fuss over the specialized, and people will be less aggressive. Don't constantly seek novelty, and people will respect ownership. By not showing off what you have, those around you will be more relaxed. So the best way to go about your business is with an empty mind and a full belly. This will weaken ambition and strengthen bones. Get rid of all preconceived notions and all ideas about what you need and don't need. Let the person who knows exactly what must be done stop to wait. Then things will work out for the best, the way they should. The Tao is being continually washed away, yet its practical presence is forever felt. There is always enough of it, a deep pool and the source of this world. It calms the aroused and untangles confusion. It rhymes light and joins the ordinary, clear as crystal while it seems to gather. We have no idea whose child it is. It was before all that just begins. Heaven and earth play no favorites. All of us are nothing more than scarecrows. Heaven and earth are joined by emptiness, like a flute wrapped in cloth, empty but never useless, a hollow music comes from. Not much to say, nothing better than staying in between. The secret of the valley is open, a female principle. This female principle is the gateway, most commonly called the root of heaven and earth. It goes on and on, like thread off a spool. Whatever you do with it never wears it out. Heaven lasts and earth a long time. Heaven and earth have been around a long time. Because they take no interest in themselves, they last a long time. This way the last are first. Whoever forgets themselves are well remembered. All plans laid aside are well laid and made to last. Best to be like water, always useful, never difficult, settling in low-lying places most people consider foul, something it shares with the Tao, looking for some place to live, the important thing is situation. In matters of the heart, the important thing is depth. As for relationships, the important thing is kindness. With words, the important thing is sincerity. Being in charge, the important thing is fairness. Undertaking anything, the important thing is ability. Making any move, the important thing is timing. Where there is a lack of aggression, there is a lack of ill will. From time immemorial, the Tao bestows upon its ardent followers something fine and incredibly detailed, an immeasurable insight, hard to put into words, a makeshift way to say, look for the uncertainty of someone walking on thin ice, the confusion of someone who listens to everything his neighbors say, the cautious courtesy of someone making a first visit, someone who, upon first meeting, seems as interesting as a slow thaw, who is a bit simple and rough around the edges, as open and uncomplicated as a gap in the hills, someone somehow mumbled into being. Let muddy water sit and it grows clear. Slow, deliberate strokes quicken and lift the motionless to take flight. To follow the Tao means being unfulfilled, never done, never starting all over again. Empty yourself, keep a deep quiet. Everything arises side by side. See them answering one another, a multitude whose each part goes back to its root. This return is called stillness, or coming to what you are. Coming to this, you come to something in common. Knowing this in common is said to clear the mind. Not having this in common makes you silly and sad. Recognizing it makes things easier. This ease is open to everything. With this openness comes control, a control that reflects heaven. And close to heaven, you are close to the Tao. And that way, nothing bad will happen to you. Whoever sets us a good example moves without leaving a trace, speaks unmistaken and blamelessly, follows through without an agenda, closes the door but does not bolt it, still it can't be opened up again, ties cordless knots that won't be undone. Whoever is worthy of our attention offers constant aid and ignores no one, holding on to whatever is useful. This is called carrying out clarity. Whoever knows will teach the person who doesn't. Whoever doesn't know provides the teacher with something to do. To ignore what is taught or who teaches, despite all one's resources, is to be way off the mark. To realize this is to fulfill an essential necessity. Be well aware of what happens around you, but hold firm to what happens inside you. Let the stream of everything and that continuity will never abandon you and will restore your purity. Pay attention to what is obvious, yet keep in mind what is obscure. Then how the world works will appear to you. When the recurrent momentum of things completes itself, nothing has an ending. When you realize your place in the world, remember the uncertainty you rose from, and the work of life itself will crease you, and this mark will be enough to return the possible. When the possible takes shape, the actual emerges. When this is made use of, direction is manifest, and important things happen without falling apart. Wanting to scatter something, first gather it. Wanting to weaken something, first strengthen it. Wanting to neglect something, first make much of it. Wanting to ruin something, first build it up. This is called hiding the light. Soft and easy outdoes tough and rigid. No fish should be allowed out of deep water. A country's cutting edge should not be seen. Time, all these were one. The sky was one because of clarity. The earth was one because of settlement. The mind was one because of haste. The empty was one because of abundance. Everything there is was one because of imagination. Those in authority, because of one, the world put right as a logical result to this. If the sky is lost, its clarity would probably crack. If the earth lost what holds it up, it would probably drift apart. If the mind lost its haste, it would probably stop altogether. If the empty lost its abundance, it would probably use itself up. If everything lost its imagination, everything would probably be extinct. Those in authority losing power and respect would probably topple. So it seems that what we value highly begins as something ordinary, and that what we see as exceptional starts out as something basic. This is the reason those in authority describe themselves as alone, friendless, at loose ends, which is probably the result of some basic underlying corruption, and all the more reason to be noteworthy but not renowned. It does no good trying to glitter and sparkle like jade. Better to be just there like a pebble on the ground. Those who know don't say so. Those who don't know so stop up the gaps, shut the doors, ease the tensions, loosen the tangled, blur the glare, muddy the hand. This is the hidden joining of what is alike. This is why intimacy is so hard to have. This is also why being alone doesn't work, which is to make no profit yet never suffer serious losses, or always fail to win awards but never be undervalued. All the above makes this priceless. Taking on something big is like frying a small fish. With the Tao, there's nothing tricky. Okay, maybe a bit edgy, but not dicey. And no one gets hurt. The Tao soaks all that up. A big country should be a backwater, an intersection of all there is. The part that is most vulnerable, a quiet that overcomes clatter. The stillness settling beneath things when a larger country bows to a smaller. The small one is taken over, or when the small country gives the larger pride of place, the greater is won over by the lesser. So through a lack of assumption, some come into power. while others, equally modest, find themselves overshadowed. Usually what the larger country wants is to contribute and nurture, while the smaller needs to belong and be helpful. When both get what they are looking for, things work out according to plan. The greater country claims the supporting role. Everyone says my Tao is great and unlike anything else. Yet that greatness comes from being unlike anything else. Were it like everything else, it would have vanished long ago. I have three treasures, hold and keep them. The first is called mothering, the second is called moderation, the third is called daring not to put yourself in front of others. A mother's kindness makes you fearless, moderation makes you generous. Daring not to be first lets you do what you daring not to be first lets what you do last a long time. Nowadays, if you abandon a mothering care in order to be brave, or give up economic measures to be open-handed, or come up from behind the forefront, death will be, in the end, the result. If you take love into the fight, you will win. Your position will be clear and strong, the way things are. Rescue as well as refuge are held in a mother's arms. What I say is very easy to understand, very easy to follow, yet no one understands or follows it. What I say has a source, and what I do has its reason. And because people don't understand this, they can't understand me. For those few who do, I remain precious. This is like a piece of rough burlap wrapped around a piece of jade. There is nothing in this world gentler or weaker than water. Yet for taking on the solid and insistent, nothing can beat it. This absence of force makes for ease. The indefinite overcomes certainty. Letting go loosens an unyielding hold. There isn't anyone who doesn't know this, yet almost no one's able to carry it out, which accounts for these words of wisdom. Get your hands dirty in public, and you will be seen as the landowner's friend. Take on an ill-fated project, and you will find yourself in charge of everything else. Although these words are in the right order, the sense they make goes in another direction. And the closing section. The confidently said is never flashy. The flashy remark lacks all confidence. The person who knows what he's talking about never argues, while the person who doesn't know what he's talking about always argues. A person who understands something doesn't dabble, yet the dabbler never understands anything. Avoid the accumulation and expansion of things. Put what you have to other people's use. Do that and you will experience true accumulation. The overreaching Tao is pointed, but doesn't injure. The specific Tao is to do what you do without arguing. Okay. Thank you.
This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and today we've been listening to several readings by and interviews with poet Thomas Meyer. Thanks to Jeffrey Beam for the tape of the 1994 reading, and to WCQS, where the interview with Tom was originally recorded. Wordplay shows are now permanently archived at iBiblio.org. For a catalog of shows, at least until I develop an interface at iBiblio, you can visit naturespoetry.blogspot.com for a listing and links. That's Wordplay for this week. Thanks so much for listening.